Good morning, everyone. Get your tests out, your quizzes. We'll give the answers at this time. Go to the geography side first. Please check them wrong if they are wrong. If you want to write it in pencil so that you can erase these and use them for upper levels at home, you're welcome to do that. Question number one on geography is B, as in boy. 2G, 3A, 4C, 5D, 6C again. 7 is a G, 8D, 9 is D again. 10 is C, 11F, 12A, 13 is also A, 14B as in boy, 15 is also B, 16E, 17G, 18D, 19D, 20 is C. 21 is a C, 22A, 23C, 24B, 25B, 26C, 27A, 28 is a B. Flip it over. Vocabulary quiz. Number one is an I. Number two, J. 3E as in elephant. 4B as in boy. 5G, 6A, 7D, 8H, 9F, and 10 is a C. Okay, any repeats? Some of you just came in. You might want to check with your friends to get the correct answers. Any particular repeats? Okay, now, I've checked that. How many of you had two or less wrong? I'm going to see your hands. You're rather normal. This is interesting. Okay, this is not a geography class right now, but these are all real places, and this is a fun kind of thing to do. It's a surprise. Your boys and girls, especially 8th graders and 9th graders, they know about everything there is to know in the world, right? Can anybody tell me where number 10 is located in geography? I wish I had a map here, but I can't spend much time at this to show you exactly where in the world this is. Who got number 10 on geography correct? Okay, you two or three. Tell us, this young lady right here, where is Monaco?
Scott says it's St. Jerome. No, I don't remember exactly.
Okay, where is it? Next young man. It's not a city. Yes, it is a city, but it's more than a city. Oh, so on the side of France. Okay, it's down on the Mediterranean Sea. It's just arched up into France real neatly. It's one of the smallest countries in the world. It's a postage stamp country. The stamps from the country of Monaco are valued. Okay, check it out in your encyclopedia. Okay. Of course, this is not a quiz you would give the first, second, third, fourth, or fifth graders. It's something that you would give for upper graders or if your teachers want something fun to do among yourselves. Okay, let's go to the vocabulary side. Yesterday, I read to you the bells. Did you listen and hear number 6 in that poem? Okay? Did you know that Edgar Allan Poe invented that word in that poem? How many of you got that one right? I'd like to see. You know what? If I wouldn't have read that poem, you probably wouldn't have gotten it right. Or maybe. Unless you all know your vocabulary quite well. Okay. So there's a lot of fun things that we could do there. If you got two or less wrong, that meant you got from an A minus to an A someplace, but nobody did, so we won't discuss where you might be percentage-wise. Okay, I'm always on the lookout for surprises. We're talking about the routine of surprise, right? The focus, the most important part here is the routine, not the surprise. Okay? The routine of surprise. So yesterday, we're eating lunch. And a young man by the name of David and his wife, Treva Iker, were there. And I got a surprise. I want to tell you about the surprise. You don't have to show pictures for surprises. You just simply harvest whatever surprise comes. I got a question for you. Are a person's two ears identical? I see a bunch of heads going like this. These two things right here, are they identical? Look at me. Doesn't my one ear stick out further than the other one? Some people, their one ear is higher than the other, right? Some people have their ears shaped differently. If you don't believe me, study people's ears sometime. Okay? Here's the surprise I got yesterday. How many of you are right-handed? Put your hands up. Okay, put your hands down. If we would open up your skull, probably the left side of your brain is bigger than the right side. How many of you are left-handed? For you few people, then the right side of your brain is bigger. Now, what about a person who's dyslexic? David Eicher is a specialist in dyslexia, and he says if a person has dyslexia, both sides of their brain are about the same. And the brain has confusion trying to work this thing out. That was new for me. Okay, so we'll just leave that. Now, I have more to present today than I'm ever going to get done, so I will just have to keep moving. The first thing I'd like to do is have the lights out. Okay. Like I say, I thank you, Daryl. I don't know where I got this. But I shared that with my students. Wow. That looks real, doesn't it? We gave it to a little boy. I think he was in third grade, and he was just sure that there are these things. He took it home, showed his dad. You know, it's fun. Just let him think that for a while. Then you can ask him some questions. How many neck muscles would it take to keep those antlers up there? It can't be real. The photography is superb. You can't see where. Well, if you look real carefully, you can see where some of this has been patched together. Okay, well, I can't linger too long on that picture. We're doing surprises. I'm just giving you some different ideas here. But recently, I got an email about baboons, and I'd like to share all these with you. Now, I'm even going to read this as we go. This is from Sunlit Kingdom. Some of you might even have said, got this. May the Lord be praised. He also made baboons. Even though we sat around a kerosene lamp on long winter evenings in Canada years ago, I traveled all around the world evening after evening, fully intrigued by the colorful photos and stories of our National Geographic magazines. Nothing was too remote or too exotic to strike my interest. Siberian old believers, Australian adventurers, explorers to the outback, brilliant plants and jewel frogs in tropical rainforests, or the impressive cultures of early Byzantium and Angkor Wat. I liked everything very much. Except one kind of photos, the baboon photos. Quickly, I would flip the page. Why on earth did God ever make hideous animals like this? Was he using them to make fun of us? Or did the devil himself have anything to do with this? I shuddered at these ghastly faces, but only years later did some of the baboon faces begin to make sense to me. The male mandrill above, that was on the previous picture, for instance, does not think he looks hideous. He's very proud. He thinks he looks magnificent. With all his outlandish colors, he's hoping to impress or intimidate his rivals. Isn't that exactly what some of us humans have in mind? And isn't this exactly how we look to others if we're proud? I'm afraid our loving Heavenly Father needed to show us through the baboons how we really act, look, and relate to others around us. May the Lord help us to learn from them, whether we like it or not. This poor old African baboon has just had a haircut. On top of this, he has some sore patches on his face. How do you feel about him? I feel sorry for him. And guess what? If we had troubles, if we're really humble, just some ordinary Joe, our friends reach out to us and love us. It's much easier for us to love poor, humble people than for us to love proud, rich, smart people. And that is still referring to this previous photo. Now, we're on to this particular picture. This is a sacred baboon from Egypt. For thousands of years, Pharaoh and his servants worshipped these animals and respected them very highly. Did this affect them? Sure looks like it. This is just how we look to others when we try to give others a piece of our minds. We may intimidate people, but we certainly do not win any friends or supporters. Close to where we lived in Canada, a very large Anabaptist group had inner problems. All the ordained brothers met to solve the problem, but they could not agree. Finally, the main leader stood up and laid it all out. This and that is what we will do, he declared. And there's something there in German that I don't know. Oh, there's what it is, and I'm the bishop. Nobody had anything more to say. They all went, hitched up their horses, and went home. But was this the end of the problem? Far from it. People just started to leave the church right and left. Thankfully, after many years of conflict, a new crop of leaders have taken that old brother's place, and the church is flourishing again. The most humble church leaders get by far the most done. This kind and friendly proboscis monkey listens to what others are saying and easily makes friends. Even if he does not look so great, all his companions and neighbors in the rainforest like him. But when he loses his temper, when he gets loud and pushy, his nose swells and turns bright red. God could very easily have fixed us with that same feature. Very advantageous, actually, because much hypocrisy could have been avoided. But he didn't. All we need to do is look at this monkey and learn. These monkeys will die in peace as animals. But if we hide anger, bitterness, hatred, and disgust, it will come out to the light on the last day. This big baboon stands tall, strong, and mighty. No doubt he has many important things to do, supplying his growing family with food while protecting them from all danger. But thankfully, he takes time for his little children. Only through teaching and training them can they possibly survive in the African wilderness. I respect this daddy baboon. Every hour I spend with my precious human children is an hour of blessing, and every chance I lose to spend time with them is precious time that is forever lost. This skinny mother in the bare, dry desert in Africa has a hard time feeding her baby, but she is a good mother. When the little one gets tired, she carries it along and cuddles it to nurse. What a blessing when real mothers love their children and take care of them as God ordained it. On the other hand, how horrible that so many human mothers abandon or even kill their babies today, or who abuse them, neglect them, or throw them out into the world, something that no baboon mother would ever dream of doing. Baboon mothers will stand in judgment against hundreds and thousands of human mothers on the day when Jesus comes to judge the earth. Baboon community. Who decides where to go and what to do next? Can they do it peacefully together? Any money troubles? Any bickering about nothing or leadership disputes? Even if they do have them, once in a while the ordinary get along much better than most of us humans. And if they have a problem, they always get over it and keep on traveling together. The little baboon is still in diapers, just learning how things go in this world. Curious, thankful for its very small joys and pleasure, it is still humble, obedient, and dependent on its parents. As long as this attitude flourishes in our hearts, our Heavenly Father can teach us anything all day long. But when it stops, our great troubles began, and disaster strikes. Truly, I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever takes the lowly position of this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Hopefully, as long as we humans live on this earth, we may look at our baboon neighbors and see a mirror image of our own society, our own families, our own lives on earth, and whether we enjoy them or not, the Lord put them here to teach us values and lead us on to everlasting life. And there you see where I got it. I just got this summer. This is one of the surprises I'm going to take to my students, maybe on one of the first days of school this year, just to get them all started, off to a good start. If you want, just get that address and see if you can get some for your school if you're interested. If you're not getting enough time now, talk with me later, and I'll be glad to share that address with you. Now, may I have some lights, please? Every year, sometime during the year, I like to read this poem, and the boys especially love it. Many of you probably heard it already. Casey at the Bat. It looked extremely rocky for the Boston Nine that day. The score stood 2-4, but with but one inning left to play. So, when Cooney died at second and Burroughs did the same, a pallor wreathed the features of the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go, leaving there the rest, with that hope which springs eternal within the human breast. For they thought, if only Casey could get a whack at that, they'd put up even money now with Casey at the bat. But Flynn preceded Casey, and likewise so did Blake, and the former was a puddin' and the latter was a fake. So on that stricken multitude a death-like silence sat, for there seemed but little chance of Casey's getting to the bat. But Flynn let drive a single, to the wonderment of all, and the much-despised Blakey tore the cover off the ball. And when the dust had lifted and they saw what had occurred, there was Blakey safe at second and Flynn a hugging third. Then from the gladdened multitude went up a joyous yell. It rumbled in the mountaintops, it rattled in the dell. It struck upon the hillside and redounded on the flat. For Casey, mighty Casey, was advancing to the bat. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing and a smile on Casey's face. And when responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat. No stranger in the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 10,000 tongues applauded them when he wiped them on his shirt. Then when the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance glanced in Casey's eye, a sneer curled Casey's lip. And now the leather-covered sphere came hurling through the air, and Casey stood a-watching it in haughty grandeur there. Close by the sturdy batsman, the ball unheeded sped. "That ain't my style," said Casey. "Strike one," the umpire said. From the benches, black with people, there went up a muffled roar, like the beating of the storm waves on the stern and distant shore. "Kill him! Kill the umpire!" someone shouted someone on the stand. And it's likely they'd have killed him had not Casey raised his hand. With a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's visage shone. He stilled the rising tumult. He made the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and once more the spheroid flew. But Casey still ignored it. And the umpire said, "Strike two!" "Fraud!" cried the maddened thousands, and the echo answered, "Fraud!" But one scornful look from Casey, and the audience was awed. They saw his face grow stern and cold. They saw his muscles strain. And they knew that Casey wouldn't let the ball go by again. The sneer is gone from Casey's lips. His teeth are clenched with hate. He pounds with cruel vengeance his bat upon the plate. And now the pitcher holds the ball. And now he lets it go. And now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this favored land the sun is shining bright. The band is playing somewhere. And somewhere hearts are light. And somewhere men are laughing. And somewhere children shout. But there's no joy in Boston. Mighty Casey has struck out. Now, how do you feel after you finish that poem? A lot of people have read that poem, and they've not felt very good about it, and so somebody wrote Casey's Revenge. It says, being a reply to the famous baseball classic, Casey at the Bat. I'm not going to read that to you. You can read that for yourself. But James Wilson, the first one was written by Ernest Lawrence Thayer. That's what I read to you. Casey's Revenge was written by James Wilson. It's kind of written in the same style, but somebody wasn't even satisfied with that. A third one, Casey, 20 years later, came around, written by S.P. MacDonald. It's been a powerful poem. It's resonated with many people. Check it out sometime. Okay, lights off, please. Would someone care to interpret the top political cartoon for me? What's going on there?
The economies of most European countries are dropping. And Germany is the one that's supporting them, falling.
Who's the guy jumping off the other side? Look closely.
Obama.
So the point of this cartoon is that Germany is sustaining the economics in Europe, and the United States doesn't care. It looks like disaster is in the process, right? Yeah, that's the message for that political cartoon. Okay. This one, we'll take a look at. Someone explain what's going on there. It relates to one of the cartoons I showed with you yesterday.
Neither side won the Supreme Court battle over Arizona.
Okay. Neither side, or both sides claim victory on the battle between Arizona and the United States. Good. Thank you. Okay. Can you all read what this says right here? It says, "We are the most open and transparent administration in history." The lesson's kind of obvious on that one. And this one, the words say, "When you said you'd wash my mouth out with soap, I decided to lawyer up." And it's referring to the Supreme Court tosses penalties for cursing. Okay, we won't make much comment there. Every so often, World Magazine does something like that. We could talk about that for a while. I'm not going to take the time to moralize or think about that, but that, just something simple like that, is something you could talk about for 10 minutes. We're not going to look at all these, but I'd like to point out this. Are you familiar with this picture? It's entitled The Scream. You've probably seen this already. An unnamed buyer purchased Norwegian artist Edvard Munch's The Scream for a record of $119.9 million at Sotheby's auction on May 2nd. It's the highest sum ever paid for art at auction, topping the $106.5 million spent for a Picasso 2 years ago. Would you pay $30 for that? Somebody was willing to pay $119 million for that. Okay, that's kind of a wow moment. I don't think any of your students would value that. But look at this. I think this one's even worse. $86.9 million, the selling price for Mark Rothko's 1961 painting, Orange, Red, Yellow, during a May 8 auction at Christie's in New York. The price was a record for a work of contemporary art. Aren't you impressed with that piece? Doesn't it do wonderful things for you? This will get your little boys and girls going. And becomes teachable moments. Okay, if I could have some lights, please. Okay. Every year or every few years, 2 years, I like to read this. This is an incredible piece. You all know who Mark Twain is. How many of you have ever read the War Prayer? A few of you. I would like to read it to the rest of you. And I cannot show you all the pictures, but I'm going to stand up here, and if you can see some of the pictures, I'm going to stand with my back to you. It's a pedagogical thing you never do, okay? Turn your backs to the students, but you're all big boys and girls, and you're not going to get away with anything with my back turned, all right? Let's read this. To Dan Beard, who dropped in to see him, Clemens read the War Prayer, stating that he had read it to his daughter Jean and others, who told him he was not print it, for it would be regarded as sacrilege. Still, you're going to publish it, are you not? Clemens, pacing up and down the room in his dressing gown and slippers, shook his head. No, he said, I've told the whole truth in that, and only dead men can tell the truth in this world. It can be published after I'm dead. This was published first in 1923, and Mark Twain himself died in 1912. So, it took a while till this got published, but this is what it says. The War Prayer. It was an exciting time of great and exalting excitement. The country was up in arms. The war was on. In every breast burned the holy fire of patriotism. The drums were beating, the bands playing, toy pistols popping, the bunch firecrackers hissing and spluttering. On every hand and far down the receding and fading spread of roofs and balconies, a fluttering wilderness of flags flashed in the sun. Daily, the young volunteers marched down the wide avenue, gay and fine in their new uniforms, the proud fathers and mothers and sisters and sweethearts cheering them with voices choked with happy emotion as they swung by. Nightly, the packed mass meetings listened, panting, to patriot oratory, which stirred the deepest deeps of their hearts and which they interrupted at briefest intervals with cyclones of applause, the tears running down their cheeks the while. In the churches, the pastors preached devotion to flag and country and invoked the God of battles, beseeching his aid in our good cause, in outpouring a fervent eloquence which moved every listener. It was indeed a glad and gracious time, and the half-dozen rash spirits that ventured to disapprove of the war and cast a doubt upon its righteousness straightway got such a stern and angry warning that for their personal safety's sake they quickly shrank out of sight and offended no more in that way. Sunday morning came. The next day, the battalions would leave for the front. The church was filled. The volunteers were there, their young faces alight with martial dreams, visions of the stern advance, the gathering momentum, the rushing charge, the flashing sabers, the flight of the foe, the tumult, the enveloping smoke, the fierce pursuit, the surrender. Then home from the war, bronzed heroes, welcomed, adored, submerged in golden seas of glory. With the volunteers sat their dear ones, proud, happy, and envied by the neighbors and friends who had no sons and brothers to send forth to the field of honor, there to win for the flag or failing to die the noblest of noble deaths. The service proceeded. A war chapter from the Old Testament was read. The first prayer was said. It was followed by an organ burst that shook the building, and with one impulse the house rose with glowing eyes and beating hearts and poured out that tremendous invocation, God the all-terrible, thou who ordainest, thunder thy clarion and lightning thy sword. Then came the long prayer. None could remember the like of it for passionate pleading and moving in beautiful language. The burden of its supplication was that an ever-merciful and benignant Father of us all would watch over our noble young soldiers and aid, comfort, and encourage them in their patriotic work. Bless them. Shield them in the day of battle and the hour of peril. Bear them in his mighty hand. Make them strong and confident, invincible in the muddy, bloody onset. Help them to crush the foe. Grant to them and to their flag and country imperishable honor and glory. An aged stranger entered and moved with slow and noiseless step up the main aisle, his eyes fixed upon the minister, his long body clothed in a robe that reached to his feet, his head bare, his white hair descending in a frothy cataract to his shoulders, his seamy face unnaturally pale, pale even to ghastliness. With all eyes following him and wondering, he made his silent way. Without pausing, he ascended the preacher's side and stood there waiting. With shut lids, the preacher, unconscious of his presence, continued his moving prayer, and at last finished it with the words uttered in fervent appeal, Bless our arms. Grant us the victory, O Lord our God, Father and protector of our land and flag. The stranger touched his arm, motioned him to step aside, which the startled minister did and took his place. During some moments, he surveyed the spellbound audience with solemn eyes in which burned an uncanny light. Then, in a deep voice, he said, I come from the throne bearing a message from Almighty God. The word smote the house with a shock. If the stranger perceived it, he gave no attention. He has heard the prayer of his servant, your shepherd, and will grant it, if such shall be your desire, after I, his messenger, shall have explained to you its import. That is to say, its full import. For it is like unto many of the prayers of men, in that it asks for more than he who utters it is aware of, except he pause and think. God's servant and yours has prayed his prayer. Has he paused and taken thought? Is it one prayer? No, it is two. One uttered, the other not. Both have reached the ear of him who heareth all supplications, the spoken and the unspoken. Ponder this. Keep it in mind. If you would beseech a blessing upon yourself, beware, lest without intent you invoke a curse upon a neighbor at the same time. If you pray for the blessing of rain upon your crop which needs it, by that act you are possibly praying for a curse upon some neighbor's crop which may not need rain and can be injured by it. You have heard your servant's prayer, the uttered part of it. I am commissioned of God to put into words the other part of it, that part which the pastor and also you in your hearts fervently prayed silently and ignorantly and unthinkingly. God grant that it was so. You heard these words. Grant us the victory, O Lord our God. That is sufficient. The whole of the uttered prayer is compact into those pregnant words. Elaborations were not necessary. When you have prayed for victory, you have prayed for many unmentioned results which follow victory, must follow it, cannot help but follow it. Upon the listening spirit of God the Father fell also the unspoken part of the prayer. He commanded me to put it into words. Listen. O Lord, our Father, our young patriots, idols of our hearts, go forth to battle. Be thou near them. With them in spirit, we also go forth from the sweet peace of our beloved firesides to smite the foe. O Lord, our God, help us to tear their soldiers to bloody shreds with our shells. Help us to cover their smiling fields with the pale forms of their patriot dead. Help us to drown the thunder of the guns with the shrieks of their wounded, writhing in pain. Help us to lay waste their humble homes with a hurricane of fire. Help us to wring the hearts of their unoffending widows with unavailing grief. Help us to turn them out roofless with their little children to wander unfriended the wastes of their desolated land in rags and hunger and thirst. Sports of the sun flames of summer and the icy winds of winter, broken in spirit, worn with travail, imploring thee for the refuge of the grave and denied it. For our sakes who adore thee, Lord, blast their hopes, blight their lives, protract their bitter pilgrimage, make heavy their steps. Water their way with their tears. Stain the white snow with the blood of their wounded feet. We ask it in the spirit of love, of him who is the source of love, and who is the ever faithful refuge and friend of all that are sore beset, and seek his aid with humble and contrite hearts. Amen. After a pause, ye have prayed it. If ye still desire it, speak. The messenger of the Most High waits. It was believed afterward that the man was a lunatic because there was no sense in what he said. Isn't that powerful? I have in my classroom, or I had in my last classroom, last 2 years, a young man who has an Amish background, but his parents are not Anabaptist, and he likes to talk about war. And he likes to think about these kind of things. All you got to do is read this book. And it's just like, you didn't know what to say. Okay. I just this summer picked up a special book I'm really looking forward to using this year. It's entitled 1001 Writing Projects for Students. A paragraph a day plan for writing success. Question: why are kids today so lacking in writing skills? Answer: because they don't write enough. Question: why don't they write enough? Answer: because they can't think of anything to write about. Well, now they can. And there are 1001 projects in here. 1,000 of them. Want to hear what the number one is? Topic: an apple. Write a paragraph describing an apple or any other kind of fruit. Hint: describe the appearance, size, shape, color, taste, smell, feel, etc. to the best of your ability. That is, use your senses. One paragraph. I plan to give them maybe 10 minutes, and they're going to be sure the first day they can't do anything. But I'll probably give some kind of grade for this. Sometime during the day, they'll have 10 minutes to do that. If they don't write anything, that might just affect their grade. I want you to think about this. If you had to tell me right now how an apple tastes, how would you say it? How would you describe it? Okay, so if you say tart, does that explain everything? Okay, well, I don't want to take too much time on this. I'll just open it up random here. Number 356, it says, a top assigning chores project. If you were a mom or dad and had a child the same age you are right now, what chores around the house would you require of them each day? Write a paragraph explaining your answer. By the way, this is written by a friend of mine, Fred Cooper. I know the man, and he's a common sort of person. He's a homeschool dad, so he knows what he's talking about. Here's number 539. Topic: the first thing I do each day. Project: write a paragraph describing the first thing you do each day when you get out of bed. So this is not some abstract stuff way off in the distance. This is where their real world is. So, just a little idea for you. All right. I'd like to have the lights off again, just to show you some more interesting things. Just found that picture somewhere. And another picture. Well, that'll make talk. You showed that in your class. That will make the talk. And these are a whole bunch of common things. You know what? I don't think I prepared my paper here with what all these things are. That has something to do with computers, what it looks like on a computer board. And all these yellow places right here is what it actually was, and I didn't want you to see what they were, so I copied these with something over it. If you want to know what they are, I do have the answers. Well, that's pretty obvious. That's an ant carrying a microchip. I'm not sure which way that is. I guess it doesn't matter. I think that one's human sperm. I remember what this one is. That's a human eyelash. It looks kind of cruddy. But your skin's not that cruddy, is it? You can do some guessing games on this with your students. Anybody have any idea what that is? That's a strawberry up close. I'm not sure which way is that. Which way is up and which way is down? Those are the eyes of a tarantula. The eight eyes of a tarantula. Those are some kind of egg cases on a raspberry, I think. I think that's the head of a mosquito. I think that's the contents of the surface of a human tongue. You know, the bacteria and all the stuff that's on your tongue. I think that's the tobacco and the wrapper with some of the tobacco off. It'd be fun to ask you some questions about that one. But we men use razors to shave. That's a shaving razor. That's a louse on a human hair. That's some kind of rusty nail. It's corrosion or something metal. I think that's the spores on a mushroom of some kind. That's the Velcro hooks and stuff that makes Velcro work. That's dust and pollen and all the stuff that is flying around in a room. And that's nylon stockings up close. And so we'll just have to quit with that. Thank you very much for your attention.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.